Hi, I'm Mel Pickup, Chief Executive of Bradford Teaching Hospitals, and welcome to this month's episode of our podcast series, where I'm sitting down with colleagues and partners from across the Trust and the wider community to find out more about them and their contributions to the health and well-being of the people here in Bradford. Today, I'm focusing on one of our key partnerships within the city, and so it's apt that we've taken the show on the road and find ourselves in City Hall to chat with the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Bradford, Professor Shirley Condon. Hello, Shirley.
Hi, Mel.
So, Shirley, I think we've got a number of things in common, not least that we are privileged to occupy leadership positions in this great city. But what I'm particularly interested in is the fact that you and I both started our careers as nurses. Mm. Can you tell me what it was that inspired you to go into the nursing profession?
Well, my mum, who lived in Blackhall Colliery at the time, had quite a lot of aunties, and two of them in particular I used to spend quite a bit of time with, and they were both nurses. One of them had started off her career as an auxiliary nurse during the end of the Second World War, and I used to listen to their stories and was just in awe of what they did, their experiences, and how they sort of came across as very caring, but, you know, doing a really important role for many, many people. And then they had some children themselves, and a couple of those ended up being nurses as well. And that's where my interest originally sparked. And obviously, there was a moment when my grandfather was in hospital and needed surgery, and I was sort of wanting to see him, and they thought I was too young. Might have been about 8 or 9 at the time. And went and was just overawed by watching what was happening on the wards, the nurses in particular wearing their purple uniforms at that time, very starchy hats. And it just set in stone, I think, a real interest. I think the other thing was nobody put any other options in front of me. So we weren't sort of encouraged to think about a lot of careers at that time. And my parents were just happy that I was doing well at school and being a good girl. So I went into nursing.
Oh, that's great. I mean, I've got similar stories, and in that, I think that exposure through our relatives. It was, for me, it was my great grandmother, and she was diagnosed with cancer when she was 75. And it was the same. It was that kind of, wow, this is really not just interesting stuff, but impactful. Mm. And having a huge impact on the lives of other people. And caring for people who are really vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So I was also interested, yesterday I saw on social media colleagues at Calderdale Hospital had got a patient in there who was 102, and she had been a nurse and she trained in Leeds, and she'd written a poem and they'd recorded it and they put it out on social media, and it was fantastic. And funnily enough, not surprisingly, she talked about the starched aprons and the starched collars and the inspection by the senior nurse every morning to take makeup off, and things have very definitely changed somewhat since then. But it was really lovely to listen to her.
Well, Fiona Bruce was on TV on Sunday, and they were covering the whole programme was about nursing, and they had nurses talking about their stories of working during the Falklands War, working during the AIDS crisis, and really picking out the particular impact that the nurses had made in different ways across different aspects of time and society.
So, Shirley, you then moved into mental health nursing, and that had a really significant impact on you, didn't it?
Well, I think, you know, just going back to talking about my relatives, one of them in particular worked in the, it used to be an old workhouse, and then it ended up being a place where people with mental difficulties or learning disabilities, we might say now, were. And they tended to be kept away from people, but you would see these groups of people walking, holding hands, and they would have carers with them. And when I first became a student nurse and you went on long placements, we went to the asylum at Sedgefield Hospital, and I got such a shock. I wasn't prepared. I didn't know what to expect. But clearly, these people had been there for a long time. Some of them, it was their home. They were seriously, seriously institutionalised. And you'd see people that looked really old and frail, but actually they weren't really old. They were just frail and had been over-medicated, treated with, I guess, things that possibly weren't based on evidence at the time, but people thought it was a good thing to try these things. And I was just surprised at the level of such of the lack of it being a home and why people were there. So they were actually in the asylum for reasons other than being mentally ill. It might be that they had a disability, or it might have been a young woman who got pregnant and she was perceived to be, you know, have some mental problem when she didn't. So there was it really struck me that this can't be the way to look after people who've got problems. And I didn't really understand about mental health. I didn't really know what a mental health condition was, but I came to learn that not many people did during that time. And obviously what happened subsequent to that was that there was a huge program of closing down the asylums. But I think the decision to close them down might have been made when I possibly was only one or not born yet. My mother could have been pregnant with me in the 60s. And the first one that was closed down was in 1986.
Yeah.
It took all that time to really think about how can we care for people better. And so community mental health became a very important part of supporting people with mental health. And things started to be understood more about better treatments, better care, and the role that nurses could play was significant.
You just mentioned there about some of the treatments that perhaps were not evidence-based. I mean, interestingly then, your career took you into academia, and a lot of what I imagine you were doing at the beginning of that was looking at evidence-based practice. That wasn't very fashionable then, was it?
No.
I'm guessing. So tell me, how have you kind of been the pioneer, really, of evidence-based practice?
Well, you're right. It wasn't very popular. People didn't know about it. People generally assumed that what we're doing was right. So you went into nurse training. It wasn't degree level. And you were trained and you thought you were doing the right thing by applying certain dressings, certain treatments, when you maybe try to do particular interventions post-operatively with people. And somebody said to me, what are you going to do with your career? And I said, well, I haven't really thought about it too closely. And they said, well, you can either, if you're really ambitious, you could think about being a leader of a ward or a unit or a hospital, but that's generally what men do. Or you could maybe go into education. And I thought, wow, is that it? We've got these two options. There's still these two big options now, isn't there? So I went and did a diploma in nursing, which was run by the London University. And that's where I started to be exposed to the fact that, you know, research evidence is really important in making the right decisions, and that, you know, we need to move away from custom and practice. But at that time, I mean, all of the healthcare professions, whether it was radiography, physio, nursing and medicine, didn't really have a deep approach to helping students to understand the evidence base of their care and developing that evidence base. And so I spent a lot of time learning myself about research, statistics, data analysis, research methodology, etc. And then I got myself into a bit of a tussle, really, because the National Institute of Clinical Effectiveness started to emerge with big systematic reviews. And then we realised that actually the nurses couldn't read the systematic reviews because they didn't understand the language in the papers. So it goes back to education and training and trying to make sure that that approach is embedded in the curricula of all healthcare practitioners.
Yeah.
It's hard.
It is hard. And it's certainly the case, though, isn't it, that in Bradford, research is a big thing now. Increasingly, it is the thing that we are known for on a national level. There's some sort of landmark research studies, like the Born in Bradford study that relates directly to the health and care of future generations. In your time here, what have you seen in terms of the impacts that some of that has had?
So I think in terms of the work that happens in Bradford is very much based on population health. So it's about how can we help the population of Bradford to be more healthier and not need actually to get into hospital, which is where we need to be, because we really need the acute sector to be concentrating on what they do best, which is helping people with complex health needs. that require more complex interventions and free up the space and the skills of those, that workforce, to deliver that type of care while we help people to live longer, happier lives through the population health. I think that's the biggest thing. I mean, going back to what you said about mental health interventions, what was happening then is that the actual interventions were causing people to be more ill.
Yeah.
So you need that evidence to make sure the treatments aren't going to do harm.
When I do induction at the hospital, I find myself sort of explaining, very much like you have just now, the reason why research in an acute hospital is important, because we need to understand that people come to us when they're sick, when they're vulnerable, when they're anxious, and it's our job to make them better, not worse. And that's the simplest way that I can find of conveying why research is important to people who are coming into the organisation to do a plethora of jobs. And I think that's fairly impactful. You know, when you describe it in those terms, it's our responsibility to not make people who come to us for help any worse.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that takes us to the important part of the big shift from the 60s to the 70s to the 80s was patient involvement in decisions. Because even though the research might say we've got a new potential treatment or a new drug and it might help, you've really got to be explaining to patients in the best way you can. This is the likelihood that it will make an impact. And it might also have a negative impact.
Yes.
Might have side effects. And making those decisions is very difficult for people. And I went through a period of time where, you know, we would be talking to students and they'd go, but a lot of the patients that I've been talking to would say, well, you're the expert, you tell me. And so they wanted the expert to be saying, yes, we can give you this and this is what will happen. But of course, there's doesn't work like that. You know, research will say, you know, that it's likely to work in so many percentages of the population and it's likely to have these side effects. But take that evidence, understand it and go, it's hard for people. It's hard for patients to do that. So I think that that's become a key part of nursing as well, hasn't it, to help people make informed decisions.
It is. It is. So Shirley, when I started as a student nurse, I'd no idea what chief exec did. I didn't know at all what the role of a chief exec did. I'm guessing at that time for you, university vice chancellor, that was a job title that probably would never have crossed your mind when you first started your career. And I wonder what motivated the move into not just academia, but leadership of one of our great academic institutions.
Well, this might sound a bit pompous, maybe, but I don't know. I'm sure you will have been the same. So when I was in nursing, I used to watch people, watch what they did, watched how they performed, watched how they led the ward, watched how they interacted with people. And I would pick people out and go, yeah, I want to sort of model myself on that type of person because I think I could do it. I think I could actually be them. And so that made it a bit easier for me to make the decision when somebody said, do you want to go down a clinical academic career? Because I thought, well, I've seen some people who do that and I think I could do that. And then, so then the move into higher education followed that route of, I think I can make a difference in a way that I would enjoy more, which would be through more teaching than delivering care, being a clinician. So when that happened, the same sort of pattern emerged. I would see people and think, wow, you're a great teacher, you're a great researcher, you're really leading the team effectively and I would like to do that. So I think as you get exposed and you sort of get promoted and you realise what the organisation, how organisations function, and that actually these big organisations like hospitals and universities have got a hierarchy of leadership and management, and that hierarchy is often gets in the way of making things better. You suddenly have this moment of, well, what if I was to be in a position of leadership? How might I do it differently? And I guess that's what persuaded me, or you know, encouraged me to think, yeah, I think I can do another step and another step. And then suddenly you find yourself being interviewed for a vice chancellor's job.
That resonates so much because I've been asked that question and I've said very similar things. You know, I never ever thought beyond the sort of next step and the next one after that. all right, so this is what a ward sister does. Or this is what a nurse manager does. I think I could do that. And when people sometimes say, well, you know, do you not feel that you've lost the impact that you could have, you know, as a hands-on nurse? Well, you do, in the sense that you're not laying hands on one individual patient, but your impact is over a larger number of patients and the teams of people who deliver that care them. So it can be equally as rewarding.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I think it's the values that pull through. I'm really, really proud of having a background in nursing, and I say that all of the time. But I did have a moment when I was in higher education, and you would introduce yourself to a group of people. They would largely be men if you were in a senior meeting. And they go, what's your background? And I go, nursing. And they go, oh, nursing.
Exactly.
Right? And I go, yes. And then you do it again and you'd get the same response in the next meeting. You went to, oh, a nurse? I married a nurse. Things like this. And you'd think, really, is that the best thing you can say? I married a nurse. And I said, well, congratulations, because
you made a good choice.
You made a good choice. But honestly, there's so many people that have gone through a nursing background who've done amazing, amazing things. And it doesn't matter what level you end up at.
Yeah.
But you do find a lot of nurses have achieved quite high positions, whether it's in healthcare, social care, gone on to business, universities.
Yeah.
It's outstanding, really.
It plays to so many different skill sets that you need to get really adept at utilising.
Mm.
And I do think it sets you up for whatever it is. I always say the world's your lobster.
Yeah. Well, it is. It is. And when you think about it, you know, there's teamwork, there's compassion, there's caring, there's managerial skills, there's mathematics, there's problem solving, there's manual dexterity,
absolutely.
You know, you name it. It's just an amazing profession.
Yeah. I know it's not lobster, by the way. I know it's oyster. Shelley, you became Vice Chancellor just as COVID hit, and that was a huge challenge for all of us across the city. It must have been also hugely frustrating at a time when you would have been raring to go with energy and your ideas, and it was almost like, to a greater extent, the pause button had been stopped. How did that feel?
You didn't really, in the moment, think, oh no, that's dashed my plans to do X, Y and Z. But what I did do was we still kept developing our strategies during that time. We didn't stop. We were still having executive development sessions with a company called the Value Circle that were helping us to be a better performing board. So that continued, but it's just really struck me more recently. Wow, I'm just starting now to do the heavy lifting on the real implementation of the strategies, because we're still in a period of where we're actually helping students and staff recover from COVID.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, so many similarities. A lot of the students that we have a shared interest in need practical skills and placements in which to practice those and hone those skills. How important is that professional experience for students, not just in health, but across some of your other academic disciplines?
Yeah, well, I would say it's fundamental. In some respects, I would like to think about the employment first and the design of the programme totally around the employment. And we say we do it, but I think we need to really challenge ourselves. Do we do it well enough? Because a lot of students now are coming into university because they see the employment as the outcome they want to get, where that hasn't always been the case. It's sort of been go to university, be challenged, be creative, be a problem solver, and then think about what you want to do after that. Most students that we see are now thinking about what the end game is.
You often talk, Shirley, I've heard you speak before, about a university not just of Bradford, but for Bradford. What does that mean to you?
So it means that we've got to play our part in the place in which we operate, or the place in which we're planted, to drive the local economy and the local agenda for skills, and contribute to making the city as strong as it can be. Because if the core organisations or the anchor organisations are strong, then we can influence the city. But equally, the city and its leadership has got to help us to be strong as well. So there's certain ways that we've got to work together to do joint planning, joint initiatives, so that there's a mutuality around it.
Talking about leadership then and city leadership, broadcaster Anita Rani is the new Chancellor of the University. A fantastic choice, really, really exciting. Yeah. How do you start with such an important appointment process?
The Chancellor is the key figurehead of the university. And if you get somebody who really, really understands what you're trying to achieve at the moment you're in now to help be that sort of front-facing, powerful representation of your values and your mission, then that's really, really, you can move mountains almost. So we started off by asking staff and students who they thought would make a great chancellor. And then we had a group of people who were sort of, shortlisting. And this job doesn't, you don't get paid for being a chancellor. And you don't go apply for it either. You get approached. Mm. So you've then got to look at the top three, say, and say, okay, let's start a conversation. And obviously we were looking for somebody that could really help us with the next chapter of the university. We wanted someone who really we could relate to the city, the students, the staff. And when you think about Bradford now with the city of culture, the young demographic, the importance of diversity, the importance of being like outward, vibrant, all of those things, we think Anita's got that.
And the Bradford connection, and a woman.
Yeah, born in Bradford, went to school in Bradford, studied in Leeds.
Brilliant. So we've got some exciting developments. You've mentioned one, the City of Culture. After 4 years as Vice-Chancellor, how are you feeling? You know, we've had a rough time because of the COVID pandemic. I'm looking out of the window here in City Hall. I can see scaffolding and building. We're right across the road from the Bradford Live development, potentially a 4,000-seater arts venue. Things are happening. I can see things and I can feel things happening in this city. How are you feeling about the prospects, not just for the university, but for the city?
Yeah, well, forever optimistic, really, because things, you're right, things are changing and they're becoming more palpable. When I speak to our students who largely come from the city region, they're just so, so inspiring. And I think if we can ensure that this City of Culture 2025 continues to gain momentum and capture their engagement and their interest, I think it will really help to firepower their confidence. I think we had 450 students in the Great Hall. Students' Union organised it. And it was a Qawwali night. They were playing music, having tea. It was meant to finish at 8. They were so, vibrant and engaged with it. People that were playing the music agreed to stay on till 10 o'clock free of charge just because they were having a great time. So it's this sort of feeling of enthusiasm and youthfulness, and they want to do great things. And all of this is all about more opportunity for our young people.
Absolutely. And we need them, don't we? We need them to be the next vice chancellors and the next chief execs of our organisations and institutions.
Yeah. And that's why they need to see leaders who are going to be open and engaging and listening to them.
Shirley, thank you so much for joining me today, and to all your colleagues and students at the university for the contributions that they make, not just to the work of my organisation, and they really do, but for our Act as One partnership in health and care, and for our brilliant city.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Mel.